But the Lord called us into classical education here in Dallas, and that's been the story ever since. Yeah. I finished the PhD program and now 12 years at the Cambridge School of Dallas and my second as head of school there.
Okay, so it's really Dr. Moriam Van Apstel, okay?
Unfortunately so.
Well, you put a lot of work and I'm sure a lot of money into that in time, so I think we ought to give you the dignity of that title, Dr. Moriam Van Apstel, so thank you. And I know you told me before we started, you actually were born in Holland, right?
I was born in Amsterdam, and still most of my extended family is back there, so I've had some trips back and forth. I've had the privilege of that. Not a native to the United States, but happy to be here.
Yeah. And how, other than, of course, in the position you are, you've got to face this whole, and I don't even know if you call it a blessing or a threat. That might be the first question to ask you. Yeah. How do you personally see AI as a blessing or a threat?
That's such a wonderful question. I've had folks come up to me and frame it as kind of a printing press moment, that it's a revolutionary technology that will change the way we do everything. And I see the point that they're making. You know, I think one thing is emphatically true, that it is going to change an awful lot. I think that can't help but feel very threatening. At the same time, I think, like a lot of your listeners, I've used AI to help solve a whole bunch of problems, whether it's fixing my car or my washing machine or just helping to think through some thorny problems. And so I see why it's making the rapid strides that it is. I also see why people are concerned. It's hard to use it without immediately beginning to become over-reliant on it as a technology.
Yeah. You mentioned the printing press. Gutenberg, was that 16th century or?
Yeah, a little bit before, but right in that target area, yeah.
Yeah, around, not too far from like the Reformation. And
right.
And then, of course, maybe another one of these moments, flashpoints, would be the computer revolution, which I guess would have been 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yes.
And then now with AI.
Yeah.
You know, I want to make sure we kind of define what we're talking about, because I just mentioned artificial intelligence. And what do we mean by that? And in what areas of our life is it already really, I guess, penetrating, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of the technology that has sort of slowly crept into our daily use wouldn't technically be defined as AI. It might be all sorts of notifications or sentence completion or use this word instead of this word that has been creeping into the way that we write and the way that we communicate for quite a while now. Specifically, AI has come onto the scene in the last few years in what are called LLM or large language models that communicate back and forth in your language of choice. I guess for me that would be English, in a way that really feels like you're conversing not only with a computer, but with another intelligence that is able to take the input that you give it, not in code, not in any other kind of broken down language form, but in spoken word English. And that makes it very useful. And it also makes it very personal and personable, which is part of the attractive appeal of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people will say, gosh, what? How is this going to impact the dignity of the human person? Because it seems like, of course, they're already starting to develop robots and very human-like type of robots. And you think, certainly is my opinion, is that you never create artificially a human being. There's something distinct about a human being. So
Absolutely. Speak
on that, where how far could it go to where, let's just say one day, hypothetically, I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm thinking, I don't know if this is a human being or a robot. I mean, could you see that happening?
I think one of the scary reality is that I can absolutely see that happening, that AI is already at the place where just interacting with it digitally, it can be hard to know. It could be hard to know whether you're interacting with a real person or not. But what that means for the dignity of the human person, I think, is very, very concerning. One of the essential dimensions of Christian theology and of Christian morality has to do with the importance of being known, ultimately being known by God, the one who made us and who calls us to himself and calls us to his purposes for us. And the thing with AI is that it can feel very much like someone is interacting with you. If you begin to process with it, as many people have done with some really unfortunate results about personal or emotional sorts of problems, it will talk back to you. It will speak as if it knows what it is that you're feeling and so on, in a way that might be more attentive, might feel more attentive than the kind of interaction that you're getting from other human beings. One of the reasons why AI in that mode is a threat is because we do have a modern crisis of isolation, of loneliness, of solitude, that is part and parcel of a mass society and many other factors that we have. But it's a real threat to the dignity of the human person, because the reality is that at the end of the day, you're not actually known by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You're entering into a space of void, a space of illusion, where there is not another person there to come out and walk with you through the actual trials of real life.
Yeah.
It's very troubling.
Yeah, and I know I'm actually teaching a class through what we call GRN Academy in January called The Dignity of the Human Person, Made in the Image and Likeness of God. And I see this as a great opportunity to... Because people are like, well, of course, we're imaging the three persons of the Blessed Trinity. So what does that mean? So I see it as a catechetical moment. Let's turn this to classical education and the kind of education that you offer, 5th through 12th graders at the Cambridge School of Dallas. By the way, cambridgedallas.org is the website. And how does this, as headmaster, and of course with all your teachers and administrators, how does this play into classical education and for good or for bad?
You know, one of the things that I tell myself and I tell others, and I think it really is true, is that at the end of the day, for all the concerns about AI, it really is a boon to the classical education movement particularly. And the reason for that is that it brings into question what the value of a person is. If so many jobs are threatened that only a human being could do before, if so many things about the human person are threatened, whether it's that relational aspect of AI and so on, what's the whole point of education at all? And classical education is well positioned to answer that question. If you talk to different folks, you'll get different answers. What I like to say is that classical education is a kind of recovery. It's a recovery of things that are always in danger of being forgotten or lost, because they are most fundamental things. They're easy to miss. They're the obvious things, and they're not necessarily glamorous. What are they? Some folks will emphasize things like the Western tradition. Some folks will want to emphasize things like traditional education methods or practices or priorities. I think both of those things have a lot going for them. What I would want to emphasize, and this has been true for classical education in the Renaissance and beyond, is it's a recovery of what it means to be a human being.
Mm.
Not to forget what it means to live with noble aspirations that pass beyond what is useful or what is simply pleasant or convenient. Never to use other people, but always to orient your life according to the things that are most worthwhile. The things that when we are greeted by St. Peter at the pearly gates, we will receive his recognition for a life well lived.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what you're really saying is that now is as good of a time as there has ever been for parents to consider classical education for the reasons that you just explained, really... talking about the understanding, more important now than ever, to understand the dignity of the human person, and it's best taught through this kind of model?
Absolutely. I think AI and the emergence of AI just puts a point on what is it you're wanting from education. Is it to raise someone who is better skilled, a better worker, and a better producer and consumer only, or someone who knows what a rich and complete life is, whether or not it is always an enriching life?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we want for our kids. For them to know the fullness of a life well lived. And that's what classical education aims at very intently.
I know. There was a superintendent of Catholic schools in Dallas who had this tagline. He says, "We prepare children for heaven and for college."
Mm. Yes.
And,
yes.
And in that order, but hopefully, chronologically, the other order.
The other way.
But the point is that the college part, college is necessary for a number of reasons, but also to get a job, because this is from a practical, pragmatic standpoint, we want to make a living. So what threat might AI have in people choosing what professions may or may not even exist? And how do you, as a headmaster of teaching kids, educate them about
Absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. This is one of these areas where there is a little bit of a guessing game. What is it going to mean for the legal profession, the medical profession, any number of professions in another 10 years when an AI will be able to produce briefs, read medical scans and so on, at least as well as, if not better than, certain well-trained experts. But I do think this presents a moment of opportunity once again, because something that will be perennially relevant is a person of good judgment. When you and I, maybe 10 years from now, are thinking about who it is that we want to hire, who it is that we want to collaborate and work with, even if, and imagine now a business setting where AI has become a pervasive use technology, you would always want people of discernment, ideally, depending on the business. I would always hope moral discernment as well. And this is one of those areas where AI will only ever be able to provide kind of a similitude, an approximation of what moral judgment might be, but it can't actually engage in moral reasoning. It's not truly intelligent or rational. It simply acts that way in a very convincing manner. So it's useful, but not ultimately able to be good.
Mm-hmm. What about the rapid change? You know, I'm in my 50s, and I would imagine that I have seen more change in my 58 years of life. But then if you went back, say, 1,000 years, maybe it would have happened in maybe 500 years.
Absolutely.
And how does that impact a person to be? It's almost like being on a roller coaster your whole life, and it never quite slows down, especially maybe for children, you know, a fifth grader, sixth grader, things are moving so fast.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think we've seen the importance of that question in the way that digital technologies like smartphones and social media have been used differently by the last three, four generations. You know, whether it's the baby boomer generation or Gen X, millennials, Gen Z, or now Gen Alpha, they all interact very differently with things like social media and smartphones. And it seems to be shaping whole generational moods, we might say, even attitudes and postures toward things like the relevance of technology, the importance of friendship and marriage, the worthwhileness of works of art and beauty. And these things have very different traction in different generations because they grew up with different interactions technologically. With AI, I think we're going to see that same thing, where it may well be that someone raised without AI, raised in a more traditional form of education, may be able to use the tool of AI without being dramatically formed or reshaped by it. I am very concerned about a generation that grows up with free access to this tool that does your thinking for you, that can, in fact, take very complex things, break them down to your level of understanding, and then kind of spoon feed them to you. It can do that well, but that means you never have to stretch your understanding to reach that higher level of complexity. Mm-hmm. It's always broken down, digested, put into your hands for you to use without you having to become more to do better yourself as a human person.
Yeah.
So I'm concerned about that generational change. Yeah.
It is interesting. You know, I think sometimes if I just, in light of our previous conversation, I want to know the population of Holland.
Right.
Or I want to know what the score of the Cowboy-Arizona game last night. I mean, I can get that so fast.
Instantaneous.
But with things like the first example, I probably would have to go to the library even, you know,
right,
40 years ago.
Right.
Drive
right
across town.
Yeah.
And so find out what is the population of Holland. I'd have to go find some resource.
Yeah.
When you look at the students there at the Cambridge School of Dallas, would you say there's more excitement about AI or more intimidation? What are the kids saying? What do they think about it?
You know, from the degree to which they talk about it, I don't think that they are embracing it quite as enthusiastically or as extensively as I might have assumed. But I think they will, whether they know it or not, because there's been such a rush by Google and Microsoft and everyone else to integrate AI, Copilot or what have you, into every product that's being used. You almost have to go out of your way to not have a drop-down menu that wants to rewrite this paragraph for you.
Yeah.
You know, and that does present a great problem. When we've had issues with students using AI inappropriately, which has begun to happen with more regularity, I'm happy to say that I think it's relatively uncommon, and that when it does happen, it's students who ran into that midnight hour and just ran out of time. And whether it was poor judgment or whether it was fear that made them not want to talk to their teacher the next morning and ask for an extension or whatever the case might be, they succumbed to that temptation in that moment. I haven't seen this sort of pervasive grabbing hold of the technology to use it instead of doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where institutional culture and commitment on the part of the school and the students, but really the families, is so important. Whatever tools you have, if they become shortcuts away from character and good work, then they're tools you want to get rid of right away.
Yeah. My guest is Mariam van Opstel. He serves as the headmaster of the Cambridge School of Dallas, cambridgedallas.org. They serve 5th through 12th graders. They're over on Royal Lane, 3202 Royal Lane in Dallas. And thanks again to Bernardo Aparicio, Director of Development and Communication, for suggesting this interview. I think one of the things that kind of first hit people's mind when they started talking about AI was ChatGPT. And ChatGPT, I think most people are familiar with that. If I was asking a teacher, or if one of your teachers said, okay, everybody, do a 500-word essay on the Protestant Reformation. Mm. I mean, within 5 seconds, you could probably get 20 different versions of this. And so that's the concern. What do you tell your teachers, and what do you tell parents? Because obviously we don't want our kids to do that. We want them to think for themselves.
Absolutely.
But it's so easy, like you say, especially if you're running late, you didn't do your assignment. What's the defense against that?
You know, the best thing really has been, I think, to recognize that when we ask our students to produce that 500-page essay or 500-word essay or some such thing, that the point is the work that's done in them through the writing of it. For one, I don't need to read another essay about the Protestant Reformation. I've read enough of them and so on. So the point isn't the product, it's the work and the work it does in the student. Working with students on the one hand to just scaffold their way through those projects, just like if you were a master and you had an apprentice working on a work of art of some kind, you would never say, don't talk to me until the product is completely finished. You would want to work with them through the steps. I think that's important. But also really the priority on reminding them what the education is for and realizing that if they do make a misstep, which many students will in one shape or form, whether it's that they cheated on the essay or that they didn't do the reading or whatever the case may be, they do have to believe in the journey or it's not going to work regardless of whether they pulled the essay out of AI or not. They have to realize the value of what's going on. And that's something that often has to be they have to be convinced of that over and over again, like we all do.
I remember when I taught high school at Bishop Dunn many years ago, and plagiarism was a very, very serious offense. I mean, when somebody was caught plagiarizing, it was really, really serious. I mean, what happens at your school when somebody is, and how do you detect it? Do you have a good program that to detect it? And what's the discipline, for something like that?
Now, that's a great question. We do have ways of detecting it. You do recognize, especially working in a smaller school setting where all the education and the direction is personal, you very quickly come to realize the student's voice and when this is just not the work that they would have turned in. It just doesn't sound like them. That's a prompt for putting it into one of these AI detection tools, and there's a few of them. But the tools are problematic. I mean, we've tested a variety of them, and most of the time, they'll give you a good indicator of likelihood of AI, but with whatever confidence it gives it to you, it's not 100%. And we've put in our own writing sometimes, and it says it's definitely AI, and we know that it's not. What that is a prompt to a conversation. And I'm fairly certain that in all the conversations I've been a part of, sometimes the student has pushed back and we've gone back and forth, and either it's based on the personal relationship I have with them or other evidence they're able to give me. It's become clear, yeah, that wasn't actually AI. Most of the times when it was, they fess up pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
They fess up pretty quick.
Yeah.
And that's going back again to they do have a pre-existing commitment to doing it right. And so they have some moral compunction about, yeah, that wasn't the way it should
have been. And you would think ideally that the student would have that desire to learn and not just take that easy way out. And I know I'm not trying to be too real, yeah. Optimistic, but I would hope that would be instilled in the school and also by the parents that, we're not paying tuition so that you
right.
that you go on AI. Let me just have a couple minutes remaining. Dr. Mariam van Opstel is the headmaster at the Cambridge School of Dallas, and joining us now talking about AI. And I would imagine in speaking to you that your goal is to graduate a student who is healthy in all regards, spiritually, educationally, emotionally. Mm-hmm. So kind of as we wrap this up, how does AI play into that for good or for bad in sending a student out of your school into the world healthy as possible?
Yes, no, absolutely. There's an old German philosopher who had a quote that I quite like. He commented that the question isn't what you do with beauty, it's what beauty does with you. And when we think about classical education and the kind of moral formation of the imagination, of the heart, of all of the desires that we want students to be cultivated in, that's what we're thinking about. I don't want you to leave school being better at using this tool, whether it's a hammer or whether it's AI, better than everyone else. That's fine. That'll be useful. But what will you do with that power? What will you do with that power? I know that many of our students will go on to live relatively quiet and beautiful lives, whether it's in marriage or in service in the church or in any other way. Many of them will also go on to have quite a bit of influence in society, quite a bit of potential to influence, whether it's the laws or culture, for good or for ill. And so when I think about any of them in any of those circumstances, I want them to leave having a greater love for what is good and what is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And needless to say, a classical education, whether it be in the grade school, the high school, or college level, is, and that's kind of the crux of what we're talking about. Because, right, you're the headmaster of a classical school, so you believe in this. But this is something you'd highly recommend, whether it be your school or a Catholic school in the Dallas or Fort Worth Diocese. This is something that parents should seriously consider.
Absolutely. And there are many different ways of hitting on what I think are the essential classical priorities, whether it's in homeschooling or a classical school or even a more traditional school. But the question is that formation of the whole person at the center of the educational endeavor? I think that's the essential question.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And thank you so much. This has been a really interesting conversation. If people want to dig in more into AI, are there any books or what would you say if people, or maybe they're learning about this and saying, wow, you know, I haven't really given this much thought. I want to really think about this. Anything that you'd recommend?
You know, the primary book that comes to mind right now is a book called 2084 by a philosopher called John Lennox that came out within the last year. It's quite a good wide-ranging inquiry into AI and all of its different facets. But the field is moving so quickly now. So I would say, whether it's through publications like First Things or other leading publications, just keep an eye on what folks are saying and what they're thinking about.
Dr. Mariam Van Opstel, headmaster of the Cambridge School of Dallas, the website cambridgedallas.org. They're located at 3202 Royal Lane in Dallas, 75229. Thank you very much for coming. It's been a very interesting conversation. And again, thank you to Bernardo Aparicio, Director of Development and Communication over at the Cambridge School of Dallas, for recommending this interview. And if you have any suggestions like Bernardo did, and you think like this would make a great interview of the week, I'm very open to it. And you can email me directly, DavePalmer@grnonline.com. We do two of these a week, and I love doing it because I learn so much right along with you, the listener. Thank you, and God bless you. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Have you heard of Christmas Joy Park? It's happening from 5 to 10 p.m. each evening from December 19th through the 22nd at St. Jude Parish in Allen. This event will inspire everyone with the true joy of Christmas as we all prepare to honor the birth of Jesus Christ this year. This is a one-of-a-kind event that blends the fun and faith of Christmas into one enjoyable experience for the whole family. It's a great way to create lasting memories with your family. Visit ChristmasJoyPark.com for more information and to get your tickets.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the North Texas Interview of the Week here on the Guadalupe Radio Network. I'm Dave Palmer, and I am so delighted to have in studio with me one of our local Dominican priests. His name is Father Carl Postgen, and he has been a priest since 2018, and he has served as the Director of Vocations, the Vocation Director for the Southern Province of St. Martin de Porres here in North Texas. Well, it's actually a big region, for the last 5 years since 2021. So I ran into him recently in a live remote broadcast, and I said, hey, let's do a interview sometime. And so delighted to have you in studio, Father. Thank you for being here. Good to see you.
Great, Dave. I'm delighted to be here too, and so excited to be able to interview with you. Like you said, I'm Father Carl Postgen, and I've served as the Director of Vocations for the Dominican Province of St. Martin de Porres for the last 5 years. The province encompasses the 11 southern states of the U.S. So while I live here in DFW, I am all over the place throughout the province helping promote vocations to the Dominican Order.
And so if, to the east, you'd go all the way to what, like Florida, Georgia, you'd have Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas. Is Texas the furthest west, or how far do you go?
That's correct. So our eastern boundary would be North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida. And then we'd have Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, and then Oklahoma and Texas.
Okay. Let's get a little bit more to know about you. I know in talking to you previously, you grew up in Spring, Texas, which is right outside of Houston. Correct. You've got one brother, one sister, and obviously parents. You went to public school. A little bit more, were you brought up in a strict Catholic family, or what was your upbringing like?
So I wasn't brought up in a strict family. My mom is Catholic and my dad is not. My dad grew up Methodist. And when they had children, they weren't currently practicing either of their faith. And my mom had a reversion experience when I was about 7 years old, and met with our local pastor who helped her resolve some spiritual issues. And then all of us were baptized soon after that. So I was baptized when I was about 7 years old. So I'm one of the rare kind of quote unquote cradle Catholics that actually remember my baptism.
Yeah.
But from that period on, we began going to Mass on every Sunday or very regular basis. And then when I was in high school, I had, through the Life Teen program at our parish, a pretty big personal conversion experience where I began to know just through the Eucharist that Jesus was real. And then in that, knowing that if Jesus was real, that I had to somehow give or dedicate my whole life to him. Mm. After high school, I went to college at Texas A&M and had a great experience both at the college but also at St. Mary's, the Catholic Center there at Texas A&M. It's a huge, bustling place with an abundance of faith and a lot of really great gifts, a lot of wonderful priests and religious that are visiting on a very regular basis. And so while I often say that I went to A&M and took my classes at A&M, really I spent all my time at St. Mary's. and my experience at St. Mary's continued to change my life and deepen my faith.
Well, I'm sure the tuition was more than worth it, even if you weren't taking the classes
100%.
Seriously, but your vocation was growing. And then once you got out of A&M, the decision, of course, is what kind of seminary to go to. How did you zero in on the Dominicans?
Yeah. I was about to graduate from college, and I always just thought I'd get married and have a normal life and a Catholic family and go from there. And I had been dating while I was in college and began asking if this relationship was ready to go to like the next step and talk about engagement. And I just didn't have a sense of peace about that in my heart. And so I took it to prayer. I was going to adoration each week, and I one day in front of the Blessed Sacrament there in adoration was telling Jesus about this peace that I didn't have. I said, I don't really know, Lord, what you want for my life. I've always thought this would be my plan, and you blessed me in so many ways, but I don't feel peace about this. And in that moment, I really felt the Lord telling me that I was called to the priesthood. I just had this idea of the priesthood in my mind. If I'm honest, I was the only person in the chapel with the Blessed Sacrament, and I heard this idea of priesthood, and I would have left if I had someone else there to keep the Eucharist safe. Mm. But I was forced by the Lord to stay there for the next 40 minutes. And I used that time to tell Jesus all the reasons I didn't want to be a priest or didn't think I could be a priest, feelings of unworthiness, personal sins, my own ambitions and personal desires. And I remember walking back to my car after adoration, thinking that all of my reasons were really lame. And I knew if I wasn't convinced, there was no way that the God of the universe was convinced.
Yeah.
And so I began having to deal with and grapple with that feeling called and yet also wanting to have my own plans.
Yeah.
But through surrender and good spiritual direction, I really found this desire for the priesthood in myself to be able to love and serve the Lord above all things. And then I think through that, I began honestly discerning. I did look at the diocese, but I pretty quickly knew I wasn't called to diocesan life. I saw how often our pastors are on their own at one parish in some places, that they're the only priest maybe for 30 or 40 minutes, and it can be kind of isolating. I didn't feel like I wanted that for myself. I'd grown up in a great family environment. I had lots of friends from St. Mary's, and I had a really good Catholic community. And so I began looking towards religious orders that had community life. And that became a pretty important thing for me as I was discerning my vocation. I also had this great zeal for evangelization. I'd encountered that at Texas A&M through St. Mary's, and this on-campus outreach we would do to help bring the faith to people who weren't Catholic or weren't Christian. And I considered that to be really important in my own spirituality, this evangelization. And so with community life and with the desire for evangelization, I stumbled into the Dominicans, who live together in communities, who have preaching as our charism, sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. And our preaching mission is supported by prayer, by community life, and by study. And all of those things seemed really enticing and exciting to me. And so while it made sense on paper, that I should be a Dominican. It was my own personal experience of meeting the friars, the Dominicans, that really sold me on this idea. I think if I hadn't met them, if I was just kind of doing this in my head or ethereally or online, I might have waited a year or two. But I had these experiences with the friars where I always felt at home and welcome and at peace. Mm-hmm. And so after that feeling of personal peace in my heart, I really thought, this is what God wants for me. And I made that jump, talked to the vocation director, soon found myself applying, and then wearing the white habit.
It's interesting because I always kind of assume that a future Dominican priest would be very much attracted to the intellectual tradition and the veritas that's searching for truth and in the likes of Aquinas and these kind of guys. And you didn't mention that. You mentioned the community life and the impression that the Dominicans made on you. Was that kind of intellectual rigor something that attracted you as well, or did that hit the radar?
At first, maybe not. Now I think it's a really important part of my life. I think at first I was originally attracted to preaching and to community life.
Yeah.
What I knew about the Dominicans' intellectual tradition, I found that exciting. The Dominicans, along with the Jesuits, are often called the two intellectual orders of the church. And certainly I think we live up to that motto or that saying. And I love our intellectual tradition now, but maybe when I was first discerning, I wasn't.
Yeah.
As a vocation director, I find the two main reasons that men reach out would be our intellectual tradition and our community life.
Oh, okay. Well, so good. We hit on both of them. So let's transition into your work as vocation director. By the way, if you're just tuning in, Father Carl Postgen is a Dominican priest, vocation director of the Southern Province of St. Martin de Porres. And I guess that maybe we can just real quickly, because you explained this to me and I find this very interesting. The United States has four provinces, right? Center, East, West, and South. Is
correct.
That right?
Yeah. That's right. So for administrative reasons, the head of the Dominican order has divided the whole world into different areas that we call provinces. In the United States, because it's such a large territory, we have four provinces. The original two provinces would have been the East Coast with friars coming from England and the West Coast, California, with friars coming from Spain and beginning those evangelization to native peoples. And then the Eastern Province would have encompassed everything from the East Coast all the way to the Rocky Mountains. And in 1939, that was split in half and the Central Province was formed, being those middle states, kind of Louisiana Purchase states, headquartered in Chicago. And then in 1979, those two provinces were split again for administrative reasons, forming a southern province, recognizing the unique needs and history of the South that was different from the Northeast as well as the Midwest.
So vocation director, obviously, a big responsibility, very important for the future of the Dominicans in the southern province. What is a day in the life like? What? Because you got a big region. I mean, Yeah. You've got all. I know you told me that there are priories in Dallas, Houston, New Orleans, Memphis, Atlanta, Miami, 11 states. Big geographical footprint. How do you carry out your vocation?
It is. It's a big job. But I'm blessed by it. What I find right now is the majority of men that meet us are meeting us online. Maybe they know us from different podcasts like Pints with Aquinas. With Dominican Classics, with the Thomistic Institute. And so people know the Dominicans just kind of through our history, sometimes through our saints, but then tend to meet the province online. You know, they'll go into Google and type in Dominican friars and we'll come up, and then they'll reach out through our website. So a good chunk of my day is spent responding to inquiries through the website as well as emails, setting up phone calls, meeting men originally on the phone, typically, or maybe over Zoom. Getting to know them, hearing about their story and about their call, and then helping them to discern. What I tell young men who reach out to me, you know, being a vocation director is not being a used car salesman. I'm not trying to force anybody into this. But what I want them to do is to have freedom to make a choice that tells the truth about who they are. I want them to have the ability to respond to the grace that God is giving them through this call. And so I'm just facilitating with them the work that God's already doing in their heart and in their life, and helping them make it a reasonable choice to either enter the Dominicans, discern with their diocese, or look at other religious orders.
Very nice. You mentioned also, previous to us starting recording, that you spend a lot of time on college campuses.
I do.
And which groups do you speak to? And, you know, if you get to get up and talk for 15 or 20 minutes, what do you find resonates the most? Or what do you kind of drive home in your talk?
So a big part of my work is doing these college visits. I visit colleges all across the province. I try to go to colleges where the Dominicans don't currently have a presence. So I go to a lot of SEC schools, a lot of Big 12 schools here in Texas. And I talk about any variety of things. I often find, for instance, we just finished the month of October. A lot of the requests I get during October are to speak about the Rosary. The month of the Rosary is October, and that's a Dominican devotion that the Blessed Mother entrusted to St. Dominic. And so it's often a popular topic that people will ask me to come and speak about.
Yeah.
I also speak about a program for young people to grow in chastity called the Angelic Warfare Confraternity. I get asked to speak about that probably about a third of the time, promoting a devotion that helps young men and young women battle things that they face and confront with chastity.
And that goes back to the story you told about Aquinas in the tower, right?
That's right. So there's a great story about St. Thomas Aquinas. He originally was an oblate or a young monk at Monte Cassino Abbey in Italy. And he encountered the Dominicans preaching in Naples when he was studying philosophy, and he had this desire to join the Dominicans. So he left the abbey, tried to join the Dominicans, and his mother was not happy because she wanted him to be the abbot of that famous abbey.
Mm-hmm.
So Thomas Aquinas' mother sent her two other sons, Aquinas' brothers, to kidnap him and brought him back to their family castle. They locked him up in the tower of the castle to prevent him from being able to join the Dominicans. And nothing would shake his devotion or nothing would shake his idea that he wanted to join the Dominican order. So finally, they sent in a woman of the night to tempt him, thinking if he's going to join the Dominicans, we would rather just ruin his vocation entirely.
Mm-hmm.
St. Thomas grabbed a hot poker from the fire and drove the lady out and then formed a cross on the back of the door of the jail cell where he was held. And after that experience, two angels appeared to him and girded him with a white cord. They said it's a cord of chastity to help keep him pure and chaste for the rest of his life so that he could join the Dominican order, devote his life to study. And so based on that experience, the Dominicans have formed a confraternity called the Angelic Warfare that we promote that help young men and young women live this devotion, this life of chastity themselves.
Very nice. Interesting that those are the things that people wanted to you to talk about, the Rosary and then this confraternity as well. My guest is Father Carl Postgen. He is the vocation director of the Southern Province of St. Martin de Porres, staying right here at St. Albert the Great Priory, right?
Correct.
I think a lot of people listening probably don't know that there is a priory basically right in the campus of University of Dallas, right next to Holy Trinity Seminary. Tell us about life there. How many Dominicans? What goes on at that priory?
So the Dominicans have been here in Dallas since the early 1950s, and we helped form the University of Dallas and have always lived on campus. We have the Dominican Priory is right off of Highway 114 on Vince Haken Street. It also serves as our novitiate priory, meaning the priory where we send our first year men to be formed. So it's a novitiate, meaning that we have men who've just joined the Dominican order. We have a full schedule of Liturgy of the Hours, morning prayer and Office of Readings at 7:15 a.m., evening prayer at 5:30 p.m. They're open to the public, Compline at 8 p.m., again, open to the public with adoration, and then a daily mass Monday through Friday at 8 a.m., Saturday and Sunday at 9 a.m. So we have a full complement of Liturgy of the Hours at mass that the brothers come and pray. We also then teach classes to form our novices in religious life, history of the Dominican order, about Dominican saints, about spirituality, about the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, you know, about scriptures, things that they need to know in order to discern their vocation to the Dominican order. And then a number of the friars who live there who are priests help at various parishes or teach on campus at University of Dallas.
And the St. Dominic, even though he was the founder, and I think he goes back to what, about the 13th century? Century or so. It's not really the most famous of Dominicans. Who are some of the other Dominican saints? I know St. Thomas Aquinas has been perhaps the most famous.
St. Thomas is probably the most famous, along with St. Catherine of Siena.
Yeah. Who's a lay Dominican, right?
Was a lay Dominican. Yeah. She's kind of now what we would consider one of the active sisters. That wasn't really a category of religious life when Catherine was alive, but she was a member of our third order, and she received the Dominican habit and lived kind of a cloistered life within her family home and then did great works of charity. She's probably one of our more famous, along with St. Thomas Aquinas. Right now, this year we were blessed to have two Dominican saints canonized. St. Pier Giorgio Frassati was a third order Dominican.
Oh, yeah.
And then St. Bartolo Longo was a Dominican friar who had been a Satanist priest and had a huge conversion and then spent his life preaching Our Lady of Pompeii and a devotion to her in Italy. So this year we had two more Dominican saints canonized, and then we have tons of blesseds and other saints that make a really beautiful history for the Dominican order.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about Saint Giorgio Frassati. Now, it almost sounds, I'm not used to saying saint. I always say blessed. He was a lay Dominican. He was never ordained. And another one who, in the Forward Diocese, we have a parish named after, is St. Martin de Porres, who has a really fascinating story himself.
So St. Martin de Porres is also the patron saint of the Southern Province. He's the saint that we're named for, the Dominican province of St. Martin de Porres. St. Martin was a mixed-race man who grew up in Lima, Peru, with a Spanish father and a free-slaved woman, black mother. And because of the laws at the time in Peru, he was not able to be ordained to the priesthood. But he joined the Dominican order and served as a lay brother or a cooperator brother. He's known for his care of the poor, his care for the sick, and incredible miracles that he was able to work through God's grace. There were oftentimes so many sick that he would bring home to the priory in Lima that the infirmary would be full, and he would bring them up to his own room and care for them in his own bed and heal them. He was known as a great miracle worker and healer. And there's huge devotion to St. Martin, especially in Hispanic communities throughout the U.S.
Going back to the vocations work, how are vocations going? You had shared some numbers with me where the numbers over the last 5 years or so are really increasing.
They are.
In the Southern Province. Can you speak about some of the numbers?
We've been really blessed with the Dominicans throughout the United States that all four of our Dominican provinces have been growing. The Southern Province has had a very, very strong growth. When I started as our vocation director in 2021, we had about 6 men in formation. We now have 23 men in formation. So we've quadrupled our numbers nearly in the last 5 years. One of the things we were just talking about, St. Martin de Porres, that we've seen too, is in the Southern Province, we've had a renewed interest in our cooperator brother, our lay brother vocation. So men who join the Dominicans, who will not be ordained as priests, but will serve the community and serve the church as religious brothers. I think it's through the intercession of St. Martin de Porres, but it's also a really important revival in the church and in the Dominican order, especially after Vatican II. The cooperator brother numbers just tanked after the Second Vatican Council, and we now are beginning to see a lot of interest again. So we've got 5 men discerning with us as cooperator brothers.
And I'm just thinking about if somebody goes into diocesan seminary, you pretty much have an idea. I'm going to be probably assigned to a parish. I'll be a parochial vicar, then a pastor, maybe one day a bishop, you know, what have you. But when somebody becomes a Dominican priest, I know, what are the range of things that you do, for lack of a better word? Obviously, you're doing vocations. Some of them teach. They live in community. What's the life and the various kind of roles that a Dominican priest would play?
Sure. So throughout the province, the brothers have a number of different ministries that we fulfill. I often talk about it as 3 kind of silos. So in the U.S., the Dominicans run parishes. So we have a number of parishes that we'll have pastors and associate pastors at. The Dominicans run a number of campus ministries at both state and Catholic universities, where the friars will serve as campus ministers, as chaplains for those. And then we have a number of friars, about a third, who serve as professors, either at the university or the seminary level. So we'll teach preaching or philosophy or theology at different seminaries. We also have about 10% of the brothers who do what I do, internal ministry, our provincial, his assistant, the novice master, etc., somebody who helps us with development and fundraising. So we have a number of brothers who do internal ministries where we're serving the needs of the province. But our kind of 3 main thrusts are going to be parish life, campus ministry, and then education.
And at St. Albert the Great Priory, which, as I mentioned, is right next door to Holy Trinity Seminary, people may not realize that there are masses daily open to the public, right? If people want to come and participate, it's a beautiful chapel. They can come. And what else can lay people do to participate in the priory?
Yeah, so all of our Liturgy of the Hours are open to the public. At 7:15 a.m., we have morning prayer Monday through Friday, and we have several people who come and join us, a lot of students from UD. At 8 a.m. Monday through Friday, we have daily Mass. At 5:30 p.m., we have Vespers. So sometimes people on their commute home will stop at the Priory and pray evening prayer or Vespers with us. At 8 p.m., we have Compline. Dominican Compline is sung beautifully, and then we close the night with Adoration. And those are all open to the public. And then Monday through Friday, we have daily Mass at 8 a.m., and then Saturdays and Sundays at 9 a.m. And those are all all open to the public. If people want to see our prayer schedule, it's on opdallas.com. People can check it out at opdallas.com, our prayer schedule.
You mentioned about the emails that somebody goes to the website and they inquire about vocation to the Dominicans, and it'll go to you, right?
It does.
How many of those are you getting in a typical week?
I probably get about 5 or 6 of those emails a day. So throughout a week, I'm probably getting about 35 or 40 emails. There's 100 emails, and some weeks there's like 2 or 3. It just kind of depends. I often think it goes with the school schedule. How stressed is a student feeling about his chemistry exam?
I want to get out.
Exactly. Maybe God is calling me to this, and I don't really need chemistry anymore.
Yeah. You can sniff that out right away. That's probably not a great reason to go into religious life, right? There's also Dominican religious sisters. Does that fall under you, or is there a female that handles the females?
So I serve as the vocation director for the friars, and then the Dominican Sisters active congregations will each have a vocation director. And then there are Dominican cloistered nuns. Our closest monastery here in the southern province would be in Lufkin, Texas, and they have they're blessed right now to have several young women joining them, but they would have a vocation director who would work specifically for the monastery of nuns. The active sisters would have a vocation director as well.
What is the difference between a friar and a priest?
So it's a funny distinction, because friars are priests, but not all friars are priests. So all of our priests are friars, but not all of the friars are priests. So friar is an adaptation from the Latin word frater, meaning brother. So Dominican brothers. All of the men in the Dominican order, if we're ordained or not, consider ourselves to be equals, and we would call one another brother. But then some of us have been given the grace of ordination, called to ministry, to serve the church in that sacramental way. So that's the distinction between the brothers and the priest. Not all Dominicans are ordained. Many will serve the church as lay brothers or cooperator brothers, but many of the brothers are then called to sacramental ministry and are ordained. But the term friar is, again, just an adaptation from the Latin term frater, which would mean Dominican brother.
Yeah, I remember the Bishop Lynch, of course, that's the name of their team, the Friars, because I think the local Dominicans used to have a much more of a presence
that's
there at
correct.
Bishop Lynch.
The Dominicans helped start Bishop Lynch, and it was a Dominican high school in its foundation.
Yeah, very nice. Father Carl Postgen, OP, is my guest. We're just about out of time. He is a vocation director for the southern province of St. Martin de Porres, in Irving here, right by Holy Trinity Seminary. And Father, we just have about another 30 seconds or so. If somebody is listening right now, and either they're a young man interested in learning more about a vocation to the Dominican, vocation, or maybe it's a parent saying, you know what, I think my son ought to hear more about this. What should they do?
So the Dominicans have a lot of great resources on our vocations website, DominicanVocations.com. They can check out all those things. We've got a suggested reading list. We've got information about the vows, about the history of the Dominican order. They're also welcome to reach out to me through the online contact forms or at our email, vocations@opsouth.org. And I'm happy to be in contact with any young person who's discerning their vocation or parents who would like more information to help their child discern.
On the reading list, is the Summa on there?
The Summa should be on there. That's not where I send my beginners, but it's a great resource.
Go read the Summa. Come back in a year, right?
Thanks for listening to KATH 910 AM Frisco Dallas Fort Worth on the Guadalupe Radio Network in North Texas. Catholic radio for your soul. Heard also at grnonline.com and on your smartphone.